This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
How do you reflect upon that from a literary standpoint? What does 829 say to you from a literary perspective? What are you talking about, Mark?
Talking about 1:14, Jesus' word, and then it's written down in Peter's words, as Peter being the speaker, instead of Matthew.
Okay, go a little further back into Mark. Yeah. What do we mean by a literary inclusio? It's sort of like two pieces of bread in a sandwich. And we have here a literary inclusio with one verse one. Mark proclaims Jesus to be what? The Messiah, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, Christos. And here in the affirmation of Peter, 8:29, you have an echo of Mark's own confession of faith. I believe we're meant to make that link between Peter's affirmation in 8:29 and what Mark tells us at the very beginning about Jesus the Messiah. What's going through your mind right now that this raises? Why does Jesus never himself use the word Messiah? And why, right after this, does Jesus say, in effect, suppress that term, let's talk about the Son of Man instead? We'll come back to that. Let's go now to the focus on Jerusalem. 8:31 to 16, verse 8. First, the predictions. This section commences with the first explicit prophecy of Jesus' death and resurrection. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Verse 32, he spoke plainly about this. What do you infer from the use of that word, plainly? Go back to chapter 2, verse 20. Picking up on what Phil said, here we have the imagery of the bridegroom, 2 verse 20. The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and on that day they will fast. You could actually render that will be snatched away. Imagine a wedding's just concluded, and the bridegroom and the bride are headed for their honeymoon, and all of a sudden they're waylaid. The bridegroom is snatched away and murdered. That's the allusion in 2 verse 20. But here in 8:31, he speaks plainly in no uncertain terms. And then the same prediction is repeated in those other references, 9:31 and 10:33 and 34. This is a most emphatic note, sounded by the evangelist Mark quoting the words of Jesus about his fourth coming death. I want you in this connection also to look at Mark 4 and verse 25. We said a moment ago that Jesus at the end of the Galilean ministry is asking about how people respond. And you've got to connect this explicit prophecy of his death with the statement of Mark 4:25, whoever has will be given more. Whoever does not have even what he has will be taken from him. The disciples have responded in faith to what they have thus far heard. To those who've received, more is given. And so to these disciples, Jesus now prophesies his coming death. And in chapter 13, the great discourse on the future, he discloses to them, as the prophet of God, the course of the future. To him who has, more will be given. Now, secondly, the geography. Geography is usually considered a dull subject. But there's something very interesting about the geography of the evangelist Mark. We're saying that starting in 8:31, the focus is upon Jerusalem. Jesus does not yet leave Galilee, but I want you to notice from the geographical notations that from this very moment, the focus is upon Jerusalem. Peter's confession is uttered at Caesarea Philippi. That's way up north, near the fountainhead of the Jordan River. Mount Hermon is northeast of Caesarea Philippi. And some people believe that when we come to chapter 9, verse 2, look at that. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. Many interpreters believe that the high mountain is Hermon. I have a question mark there because we can't be certain one way or the other. I've argued in the commentary on Matthew that the high mountain is Mount Meron, which is roughly between Caesarea Philippi and Capernaum. That's nearly 4,000 feet above sea level, so that qualifies for being high. Be that as it may, from Caesarea Philippi, Jesus and his disciples move in a southerly direction, irresistibly toward Jerusalem. Just look at the references I have there alongside number 2. Look at 9 verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Verse 33, they came to Capernaum. Capernaum is in the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. So they have come from Caesarea Philippi by whatever direction, south to Capernaum. Now look at 10 verse 1. Jesus then left that place and went into the region of Judea and across the Jordan. So they moved south. They crossed the Jordan River into Perea. Now, 10:32, they were on their way to Jerusalem. Verse 33, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed, etc. 10:46, then they came to Jericho. Here is Jericho. They cross from Perea into the western side of Judea. And then, chapter 11, verse 1, as they approach Jerusalem. I don't know whether things like this interest you, but go back to 10:32 and 33. they were on their way up to Jerusalem. Verse 33, we're going up to Jerusalem. Literally, that's what they were doing. When you go from Jericho to Jerusalem, that's a 15-mile journey, and you rise 4,000 feet over a span of 15 miles. They're literally going up to Jerusalem. But the main importance of this is theological. Geography illuminates theology. Jesus is moving irresistibly toward Passion Week in Jerusalem. Thirdly, the accent on the cross. The passages that we looked at under one predict both the crucifixion and the resurrection. But the accent is unmistakably on the cross. Mark chapter 15 gives us a lengthy account of the crucifixion of Jesus. Chapter 16 declares that Jesus has risen from the dead. I want you to turn to chapter 16. We're almost done here. Chapter 16, verse 6. He has risen. But one of the most astonishing things about the Gospel of Mark is that no sooner has the resurrection been announced than the whole Gospel comes abruptly to a close. I will disclose my position as one that believes that the Gospel of Mark originally concluded with chapter 16, verse 8. And that verses 9 to 20 are a later addition. This gets us into the debate over the King James versus the NIV. Let me simply take that position. I commend to you the commentary by Bill Lane in the New International Series for discussion, and especially Bruce Metzger's book, A Textual Commentary on the New Testament. If Mark indeed concluded at 16 verse 8, is not that astonishing? And does it not help to accentuate the crucifixion of Jesus? I want to add a footnote to that second point. If you now stand back from the Gospel according to Mark, you notice something that's quite astonishing. My copy of the NIV has about 27 pages devoted to the Gospel of Mark, and 13 of those are devoted to this closing section. If you begin at 8:31 and move to 16:8, nearly half of the entire Gospel is focused upon Jerusalem. 13 pages out of 27. And if you come to chapter 11, verse 1, the account of the triumphal entry from 11:1 to 16:8 is 10 pages out of the 27. No wonder Martin Kaler, a German scholar, called the Gospels passion narratives with long introductions. And you see how that prepares us for point number 3, the accent on the cross. Very nearly half of this entire document is focused upon Jesus' encounter with death in Jerusalem. Even though all three of those predictions encompass the death and the resurrection, when we come to the passion narrative itself, there's much greater space devoted to the crucifixion of Jesus than to the resurrection. And I took the position, shared by many, that Mark originally concluded at 16 verse 8. So there's an extraordinarily short resurrection narrative. His rising from the dead is announced, but much greater space is devoted to the crucifixion. We'll come back to the purpose of that later. Now, fourthly, a Christological inclusio. Everyone now understands what an inclusio is? Someone who just nodded his head, give us give us a concise definition of an inclusio. Now there's some heads going the other direction. Just think of it as a framework, a literary framework or sandwiching, so that at the beginning of a passage or even a whole book and at the close of a narrative of a whole book, you have the same point reiterated. I give you an example from the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew 1, I guess about verse 21. You shall call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. And inclusio with that is found in the very closing verse of Matthew. I am with you always, even to the close of the age. We have the same thing here, corresponding to what we noted yesterday, 1:1, and inclusio with 8:29, you are the Christ. Notice now, the verses indicated at the bottom of your handout, Mark 15:39, in relation to Mark 1, verse 1. In Mark 15:39, we read, when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. There is a Gentile centurion following the death of Jesus, affirming that he is huios theou, Son of God, the very phrase used in Mark 1, verse 1. You have a counterpart to that in the Gospel of John, by the way, another inclusio. Somebody quote for us John 1, verse 1.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
And the Word was God. The affirmation of Thomas, John 20, verse 28, my Lord and my God. This is a Mark and counterpart to that. Now we come to the next major theme, an historical approach to Mark. Just as theological a purpose as the literary. First, a word about the author, the identity. According to the traditional view, the author of this gospel is John Mark, sometimes called simply Mark. And I have given you there in the handout all of the references in the New Testament to this man. I'm not going to present lengthy arguments in favor of this view. You can refer to Guthrie's discussion, pages 69 to 72, for that. But this is a view deeply rooted in the ancient church. It is sometimes suggested that there's a glimpse into Mark's presence in Mark 14, verses 51 and 52. At the scene of the arrest, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. It's impossible to say for certain one way or the other whether this is an autobiographical entry into the document. Some people rather see it as a fulfillment of prophecy, Amos 2, verse 16. So we don't want to build a case on Mark 14, 51, and 52. What is important to notice is that Acts, together with the letters, identify this man as a cousin or nephew of Barnabas and as a companion both of the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter. And that leads us to the second point. Major influences.
What did you say with the 10 volumes?
In, let's see, where is it? In Colossians 4:10, some translations say nephew, others say cousin. It's enough to know he was a relative of Barnabas. But what I want to focus upon are the influences upon Mark exerted by the apostles Paul and Peter. On the oral and written sources underlying Mark, you can look at Guthrie in the pages there indicated. But notice in particular Peter and Paul as influences. In 1 Peter 5, verse 13, the Apostle Peter calls Mark my son. The dominant view is that 1 Peter is written by the Apostle from Rome, here called Babylon. And Mark, his son, is with him. Now, in connection with this, I want us to notice a bit of evidence from early church history. By the way, this is quoted in Guthrie's introduction, as I indicate there, page 70. This is an extract from the church history of Eusebius, who wrote during the 4th century. And here he is drawing upon a 2nd century author named Papias. And this is what Papias says about Mark. In his own book, Papias gives us accounts of the Lord's sayings attained from Aristion or learnt directly from the presbyter John. Having brought these to the attention of scholars, I must now follow up the statements already quoted from him with a piece of information which he sets out regarding Mark, the writer of the gospel. This too the presbyter used to say, Mark, who had been Peter's interpreter, the Greek word is hermeneutes, wrote down carefully, but not in order, all that he remembered of the Lord's sayings and doings. For he had not heard the Lord or been one of his followers, but later, as I said, one of Peter's. Peter used to adapt his teaching to the occasion without making a systematic arrangement of the Lord's sayings. It's good to hear that Peter was not a systematic theologian either. So that Mark was quite justified in writing down some things just as he remembered them. For he had one purpose only, to leave out nothing that he had heard and to make no misstatement about it. There you already have a glimpse into Mark's integrity as an historian, subject to which we will return. Such is Papias' account of Mark. Now, putting the evidence of 1 Peter 5:13 together with this, there is reason to believe that Peter was a decisive influence upon Mark. The other decisive influence is Paul and his writings. And judging from the evidence of Acts and the letters, Paul was accompanied by Mark both at a relatively early stage of his ministry and a relatively late stage. I've indicated the verses there. Acts 13, verses 5 and 13, tell us that on the first missionary journey, Barnabas requested that his relative Mark join him and Paul. And then we're told in chapter 15 that Paul objected to Mark's joining them for the second journey because he had abandoned the mission during the first journey. And so Barnabas and Paul go to and Mark go to Cyprus, and Paul takes Silas on the second journey. Now, I want you especially to notice Colossians 4:10, Philemon 24, and 2 Timothy 4:11. Colossians is written from a Roman prison. And Paul says in this verse, my fellow prisoner Aristarchus sends you his greetings, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. And Philemon 24, written at about the same time, is similar. And then we read in 2 Timothy 4, verse 11, only Luke is with me. Now Paul is, at least on the view that I adopt, in his second Roman imprisonment, near the end of his life. And he says, get Mark and bring him with you, because he is helpful to me in my ministry. Now there we have some fascinating glimpses into the historical facts about the Christian experience of the evangelist Mark. Just stand back and ruminate upon that for a moment. He has direct contact with two of the greatest apostles, Peter and Paul, and apparently for a rather extended period with both. Now, the plot thickens. We go to point B, the provenance. As we come to this, we are prepared, are we not, for signs of the influence both of Peter and of Paul in the writing of this gospel. The provenance means the source. What can we say about the origin of the Gospel of Mark? First, with respect to the place. Compare Guthrie's discussion. According to the dominant view in the ancient church, Mark wrote his gospel from Rome for a Roman audience. Mark writes his gospel from Rome for a Roman audience. And you can compare Guthrie's discussion. Secondly, what about the date? Again, the dominant view is that Mark was written during the Neronian persecution, which followed upon the great fire of Rome in July of 64 AD. I think the tragedy is that ancient history is a bore for us. I'm teaching a course on C.S. Lewis, and I just read a quote from him yesterday. Let the wind of the centuries blow through your mind. Let your imagination be sanctified. Just try to put yourself in the position of one of the original readers of this gospel. Somewhere between 65 and 70 A.D. Most likely written during the Neronian persecution in the wake of the great fire of Rome, which afflicted the city, devastated the city in 64 A.D., and eventually the Christians became the scapegoats. Notice also that during this period, the dates vary, but all are agreed that Peter and Paul were both martyred under Nero sometime between 64 and 67 A.D. Now, in light of this provenance, let's go to the next point, the life setting. If you go home and use the German phrase, you'll impress your spouse, the Sitz im Leben of the Gospel according to Mark. Our purpose here is to see how Mark uses his material to address the pastoral and practical needs of his original audience. And as I said the other day, if you attend to this, if you try to get a hold of this, recognizing the limits of our understanding, it will help you more effectively to preach this document to the 20th century counterparts of those ancient Christians. But if you make a quantum leap from this document to the 20th century setting without attentiveness to his first century setting, you will have missed a great blessing. Let's now consider the life setting of the Gospel of Mark. I'd like to suggest two matters. The first is building on the Pauline foundation, and the second is encouraging the persecuted believers. We have suggested that Mark, a companion of Paul, was strongly influenced both by his person and by his writings. Let's just assume that Mark is writing from the capital city of Rome about 65 A.D. What would he have access to?
The Church in Rome.
What documents would he have access to? The epistle to the Romans, received by the Roman Church 10 years earlier. And probably by this time, most, if not all, of the Pauline epistles. He's building on a Pauline foundation. How does he do so? First, by acclaiming the gospel of Christ crucified. You are probably already aware of the fact that at the very heart of the gospel according to Paul is Christ crucified. See 1 Corinthians chapter 1 verses 18 to 31 and Romans chapter 3 verses 21 to 26. Paul says, I determined to know nothing among you but Jesus Christ and Him crucified. The gospel according to Paul is supremely the gospel of the cross. 1 Corinthians 1 verses 18 to 31 and Romans 3 verses 21 to 26 would be two of many such references. Now, I believe that we may with many scholars see Mark as a gospel fashioned on the model of the Pauline euangelion. Mark's account of Jesus as the suffering servant has been at least partly inspired by the preaching of Paul. Let's go back to Mark chapter 15. And at this point, I want you to look at verses 37 to 39. Mark 15:37. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. Verse 38. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Before we go any further, what do you understand to be the significance of the rending of the veil? All right, the opening of the Holy of Holies for access for whom? Gentiles as well as Jews. The first one who confesses Jesus after his death is a Gentile. Now verse 39. When the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Now, I want you to look at that trio of verses in the light of what Paul teaches about Christ crucified. Would you observe that the first confession of Jesus is uttered not after the resurrection, but immediately after his crucifixion? Have you ever thought about that? Could not Mark have, if he were just fashioning his own document, have put such a confession at the empty tomb, whether a Gentile soldier or a Jewish apostle? Surely this man was the Son of God. And yet the first confession comes immediately after his death. I want to suggest another possibility. Dr. Van Gameren has cautioned me about pushing this one, but I want to mention it anyway. I ran across it in an excellent book on the Gospel of Mark by Ralph Martin, who is taught at Fuller Seminary. It's called Mark, Evangelist and Theologian, and he refers to the work of a scholar who suggests that the rending of the veil is not merely for the purpose of signaling that the Holy of Holies is now open to the people of God, Jewish and Gentile alike, but that the rending of the veil now discloses the divine glory as never before. Had the curtain been removed, no one, the high priest included, could have tolerated the splendor that would have emerged from the Holy of Holies. And yet now, the veil may be rent because the glory is embodied in a human being hanging on a cross. But that does not minimize the reality of the glory. What does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 2? They crucified the Lord of glory. And in Romans 3:25, Paul talks about Jesus as an hilasterion. That means a place of expiation and propitiation. The mercy seat in the Holy of Holies was the place of hilasterion, the place of where the divine wrath was averted. And T.W. Manson calls attention to the verb used in Romans 3:25, God set Jesus forth as an hilasterion. That is, the mercy seat is removed from the Holy of Holies and brought out into the open, and we're not consumed by the glory. We rather adore it. I would suggest that you give some thought to that. There's a Johannine counterpart to this in John chapter 12. The hour of Jesus' glorification is the hour of his death, not the hour of his resurrection. Well, that's much to think about. So, it is the crucified one who's the scene of glory and the object of confession in Mark, just as in Paul. Now, come secondly to considering how Mark amplifies the Pauline record. You may know from your study of the Pauline epistles that it is his habit to leap from the incarnation to the crucifixion. Can you give me a verse that makes just that point? Galatians chapter 4. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law. It is Paul's habit to be preoccupied with incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. Paul tells us very little about the public ministry of Jesus. It's interesting that the few references we have in Paul to the ministry of Jesus are almost all from Passion Week. So that in itself reflects his preoccupation with the cross. And now we see how Mark, the evangelist, amplifies the Pauline record. How does he do so? Don't be afraid to state the obvious. Yeah, but how does he amplify or augment Paul?
In the form that he says his gospel, goes in the same order.
Mark augments or supplements the Pauline preaching by giving us an extended record of the public ministry of Jesus. So in the first point, he acclaims the centrality of the cross, but now he supplements what Paul has preached, at least judging from the letters, to give us an extensive record of the public ministry of Jesus. And here, of course, Mark shows his indebtedness to the Apostle Peter. Paul had not been a disciple during the public ministry. Peter had. And then, thirdly, accentuating the humanity of Christ. what do we mean by this? If you consider for a moment the letters of Paul, you know that Paul affirmed both the deity and the humanity of Jesus. He is the Son of God who became a man. Romans 1 verse 3, born of the seed of David. Galatians 4 verse 4, born of a woman. Paul never denies the real humanity of Jesus. We are talking about Mark building on a Pauline foundation. He acclaims Christ crucified. He amplifies the Pauline record with an account of the public ministry. If we had only Paul, we would lack that. Thirdly, he accentuates the humanity of Jesus. Now, to get at what I want to say here, I want to quote to you from another apostle, from a letter probably written shortly before his own death. 2 Peter 3, verse 16. Paul's letters contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorant and unstable people distort as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction. Hard to understand, which are therefore more easily distorted. And following the book that I referred to by Ralph Martin, let me suggest to you that one purpose of the gospel according to Mark is to correct false teaching drawn from the letters of Paul. I should say inferred from the letters of Paul. False teaching that Paul himself would vehemently oppose. But there are strands of the Pauline evidence that could support what the ancient church called a docetic Christology. What do we mean by docetic or docetism? Yeah. The Greek word dokeo means to seem. So the docetic heresy denied the true humanity of Jesus. He was the heavenly Christ who only appeared to have a body, who only seemed to be human. Now, let me call your attention to a couple of references in Paul that, isolated from the rest of his teaching, could be taken as proof text for this kind of Christology. Romans 8, verse 3. God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. Paul chooses his words carefully. He doesn't say in the likeness of flesh or in sinful flesh, but in the likeness of sinful flesh. But you know as well as I that the word may be misconstrued. And so a docetist could read Romans 8, verse 3 and say, aha, Jesus only appeared to be human. That's Romans 8, verse 3. Another is Philippians 2, verses 7 and 8. Philippians 2, verses 7 and 8. Being made in human likeness, or being found in appearance as a man, could be so construed, isolated from the context of that hymn. So, if Mark is writing this book around 66 or 67 A.D., with most of the Pauline epistles having been written, well, all of them having been written, most of them widely circulated, it's not too early for Christological heresy to begin to appear.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.